Hey everyone, welcome in to another daily editorial here on the KE Report. In this daily editorial, we're shifting focus a little bit to focus more broadly on the nickel sector. Nickel has been a metal that has been running, but I feel like it isn't getting as much love or really notice as other sectors. There's a number of reasons for this, and we are going to dive a lot into this nickel market from an investment angle and from some of the fundamentals. We are chatting with Martin Turenne. He is the president and CEO of FPX Nickel. We have chatted about FPX a number of times. The company is moving along with its Dakar Nickel District project in central British Columbia. But Martin, you really are our go-to guy when it comes to some of the nickel market nuances and fundamentals. Let's start off high level with the nickel market in terms of size, comparing it to some of the other base metals like copper or zinc that have a much more dedicated following. What can you tell us in terms of the broad nickel market as it compares to some of the other base metals and other a bit more well-known commodities?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Corey and Shad. Good to talk to you guys again. I think at a high level, it's important to understand that the nickel market is relatively small compared to the copper and the zinc market. Looking at copper in particular, the nickel market is about one-tenth of the size of the copper market in terms of the annual supply and demand of the metal. So copper, about a 10x nickel in terms of size per annum. The smaller size of nickel has historically meant that it is therefore a lot more volatile than copper. That means that the price tends to, in peak periods, swing much higher than the copper price on a relative basis. And then conversely, in bear markets, the nickel price is prone to going a lot lower, again, relative to copper. And that really is down to the size of the market. The smaller the market, typically, the more prone it is to volatility. Very good comparison here also to the lithium market. As it happens, the lithium market is about one-tenth of the size of the nickel market. And so that same relationship of volatility between nickel to copper is also present, I think, when you look at lithium versus nickel. Nickel has had huge volatility in recent years, even more so than nickel. And, you know, certainly the upside volatility in the lithium price has shown kind of the outperformance there versus things like nickel and copper for both the metal and the equities. So I think just understanding the size of the market here is important, and the fact that if nickel is prone to higher volatility, that can potentially be, you know, higher risk, higher reward, potentially of greater interest, therefore, to speculators.
Martin, that's a good point about it being just kind of a smaller, lesser followed sector, especially in the base metals, when you think about things like iron or aluminum or copper. But the other thing is that nickel's had this stealth price rally the last few years, you know, moving from $3 a pound to upwards of $11 a pound. That's a big move in any commodity. And I wonder if some of that is this interest, you brought up lithium there, you know, this interest in the battery metals narrative, and that people are starting to wake up that nickel is a key player in batteries. What do you make of this stealth run, and is it sustainable?
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, you know, if you look back to late 2015, early 2016, which is really the bottom in these commodities markets, the nickel price was about $3.60 a pound. You know, last week it traded up to about $11 a pound. It's now pulled back a little bit into the $10 range. And if you look at the chart over that period of time, it's been, as you say, pretty kind of consistent but stealth move, but that has ultimately led to sort of a 3x in the nickel price over that span of time. You've had, I'd say, two reasons for that. One, let's call them the basic fundamental factors, where for the most part over the last several years, the nickel market has been undersupplied. Right. So demand has been stronger than supply. That has led to a drawdown in nickel stocks, and that has been positive on a fundamental basis for the nickel price. The second part of that price move, I would say, particularly in, over the more recent period in the last 12 to 18 months, has been more the financial or the speculative side. And that, to your point, is owing to the electric vehicle demand for nickel. That's still a very small proportion of demand. It's only about 6 to 7% of nickel currently goes into EVs. The rest of it, most of the rest is used for stainless steel. But that narrative around the EV demand, I think, is pointing to, you know, the kind of the hockey stick growth we see in EV consumption in the years to come. And I think to a certain extent, both speculators, financial speculators, and frankly, some of the EV batteries and battery makers and car makers themselves going into the market and actually buying up physical metal because of what they see as a huge sort of demand growth in the years to come, and sort of positioning ahead of that, which has led to part of that stronger move in the nickel price in more recent times.
So Martin, talking about inventories, you sent us a chart outlining total nickel inventories going back to 2011. And we can see pretty clearly here that inventories peaked right around mid-2016. And we're on kind of a free fall right before COVID hit. And boy, oh boy, it bounced a little bit in 2020, but now is back to levels that we really haven't seen in a decade. Can you break down this chart a little bit more too when it comes to bonded warehouse inventories, this SHFE and the LME inventories, just to simplify this for everybody, please?
Yeah, so that's a chart put out by Scotiabank every trading day, tracking global reported inventories in nickel. They do the same in zinc and copper and other metals. And so those reported inventories are coming from three places: the LME, everyone knows, and then the bonded warehouses and the Shanghai Futures Exchange. Those are Chinese sources of reported material. And to your point, these levels now of reported inventories are about a 10-year low. Those global nickel stocks are around 110,000 tons or so today in visible inventories. That represents about 16 days worth of consumption, meaning if all nickel production stopped tomorrow, there'd be enough of these reported inventories to feed the market for the next 16 days, after which those inventories would be all used up. The nickel market is actually currently not as tight, though, as some of those other main metal markets. The copper market, for example, has about 5 days of inventory in reported warehouses. The zinc market, about 7 days. So while that nickel level of inventory is quite low, and really at a 10-year low, we're still not sort of as tight in nickel as we are in copper and zinc, though I think the direction there is that nickel has some room to make up ground in terms of being tight, as physically tight as copper and zinc here in the months and years to come.
Martin, we hear a lot in the investing space about the two main types of nickel, the nickel laterite deposits and the nickel sulfide deposits, and you know, which companies are a better play, which one's going to get the premium, the usage. Could you break that down for people and just maybe make it simple for our audience? What is the difference between the two types of nickel? What's the pricing advantage, and what's the distribution in the Earth's crust?
Yeah, there's a lot to get into there. I'll try to keep it as high level and simple as possible. So nickel sulfide deposits tend to come from places like Russia and Canada. Laterite deposits, places like Brazil, the Philippines, Indonesia. So that's the kind of the geopolitical, let's say, distribution of those units. Sulfide is the traditional historical source of nickel units from places like Sudbury, for example. And there has been a very long and conventional path of sort of mining of those deposits, which are typically underground, and the associated mining and milling, flow sheets, and the smelting of those products into final products is quite well understood. The laterites are a more recent development, and they have really represented the bulk, if not almost all, of the supply growth over the last 15 years or so in nickel, again, principally from places like Indonesia and the Philippines. The laterite nickel production, while it has been abundant, it also comes with a significantly higher environmental footprint. Typically, the mining practices around these deposits is quite sort of, let's just say, less than ideal. In terms of the strip mining, the deforestation associated with that mining, there's also tends to come with very high CO2 or carbon dioxide emissions associated with laterite mining, because most laterite mining production is far away from any kind of renewable power. And so all of the processing and smelting tends to be based on coal-fired power. That lends itself to very high CO2 emissions for laterites. And while it has represented the bulk of supply growth over time, in some ways, particularly given that high environmental costs, there's a real question mark as to whether laterites can be used in vehicles that are destined for the North American and the European markets going forward. So the nickel market then finds itself having to look back to, let's say, lower grade sulfide deposits, that of which there are a few in Canada, and deposits potentially like the one that FPX has, which has a unique mineralogy that is neither not sulfide or laterite, and we think one that represents some advantages from a metallurgical standpoint that we've discussed in past interviews.
Martin, what about the pricing differences that we see between these different type of nickel mineralization? Simply because, look, pricing is slightly different, and I realize there's a different process to bring some of these to the market and also use case, but what can you tell us about the arbitrage or different pricing available out there?
Yeah, this is a really, really important part of the nickel market, and I'll try to do my best to summarize it here. So on the one hand, you have nickel sulfide mines that produce a concentrate. And those concentrates, if they're produced by a miner that doesn't own its own smelter, they have to sell to that third-party smelter. And they typically get paid around 75% of the LME nickel price. So if the three of us built a nickel sulfide mine together in Canada, we'd likely be selling that concentrate to the smelters in Sudbury that are owned by Glencore and Vale. They would pay us 75% of the LME nickel price. So we'd take a 25% haircut. That Glencore and Vale would then take that product through and ultimately produce an LME grade finished nickel product that trades, you know, for the LME price, as it would be an LME deliverable product. The laterite producers produce a host of different products. They can produce everything at one end of the spectrum. They can produce finished metal, or they can produce a product that's a bit more crude, and that's called nickel pig iron. Now, there's been a view in the market that nickel pig iron is not a great product. It contains a lot of iron, etc. But in terms of using it for stainless steel, it's very valuable. And so nickel pig iron can actually often trade at a premium to LME metal. And so it is a high-valued product in the production of stainless steel. Nickel pig iron can also be converted into nickel sulfate for batteries, though that conversion price is probably higher than it would cost to convert a nickel product that comes from a sulfide source. So the main point I would leave everyone with is no matter the type of nickel mineralization you start with in the ground, you can produce any type of nickel product. The question is, what is the cost to do so? And that's where, you know, factors like, you know, the grade, the processing cost, the access to infrastructure will factor into which projects are viable and which are not.
Well, Martin, you touched on it briefly there about the ability for some companies to be able to upgrade from pig nickel up to more battery grade nickel. And we keep hearing that this is a disruptive technology, that it's going to put a lot of companies out of business. Would you mind addressing it in a little more depth and just, you know, what are the costs for that? Is it cost effective and is it a disruptive process?
Okay, so nickel pig iron is a pretty cheap product to produce as it's currently produced in places like Indonesia. And there are occasions when nickel pig iron can trade at a steep enough discount to nickel sulfate, which is the battery chemical that goes into the batteries, to induce those producers of nickel pig iron to convert the nickel pig iron into sulfate and therefore produce a higher value product that they can sell for and earn a higher top line revenue. The question really is, what is that conversion cost from nickel pig iron or NPI to nickel sulfate? And, you know, depending on which sort of, you know, analysts you follow, that conversion cost is typically pegged at somewhere in the range of $1.50 to $2 per pound of nickel contained. Okay, so if the spread between nickel pig iron pricing and nickel sulfate pricing is in excess of $1.50 to $2 per pound of nickel contained, then it might be worthwhile for that nickel pig iron producer to convert their product into a sulfate. The issue with that, though, is that the more nickel pig iron producers do that, there will be less nickel pig iron available for its traditional market in stainless steel. There will start to be more nickel sulfate available and being produced, and that will shrink that price gap between NPI and nickel sulfate. And so that will eliminate the incentive for that conversion. So because that conversion cost is quite high, again, between $1.50 to $2 per pound of nickel, it's a problem that kind of solves for itself. If many producers do that, it will really eliminate that conversion path as a viable source of nickel sulfate in the medium and longer term.
Martin, one other aspect of the nickel market, like a lot of, other battery metals or some of these other markets that aren't as closely followed, is this whole domestic sourcing, or for large companies, where they get their metal from. Is this prevalent in the nickel industry too? And is this something that investors need to be paying attention to in terms of where large companies could be sourcing their nickel from?
It is absolutely important when we as a company, as FPX, we talk to downstream participants, so that is, you know, battery makers and the car makers themselves, they stress to us the importance of a quote-unquote domestic source of nickel, let's say for North American EV battery production. Now, it's quote-unquote domestic in that it's going to really have to involve, you know, Canadian production for U.S. automakers because of the virtual, you know, there's almost no nickel in reserves in the United States. It's just not a country that's particularly well endowed geologically for nickel. So U.S. automakers will absolutely need to rely on Canadian nickel production on a security of supply basis. And this speaks to, you know, even the theme of energy security, and also because of the better practices for nickel extraction and production, and the significantly lower CO2 footprint of nickel production from Canadian mines. And so this is absolutely a theme, and it's a theme that I think we will see ultimately play out in the market, where there will likely, in my view, be sort of significant premiums to be paid for North American nickel supply. So typically you have, you know, an LME nickel price, that's a global benchmark price, but then you will have regional premiums or discounts in Asia, North America, and Europe. And to the extent that the EV battery industry in North America grows to the extent that everyone is envisioning it, that will require a lot of nickel units to get pulled into North America. That will lead to significant premiums, I think, for North American nickel supply. And that I think is strategically very important for North American, you know, miners and project developers.
Well, Martin, we just saw, you know, a big announcement from Tesla doing a deal with Talon Metals for just that kind of a end user trying to lock in supply in a domestic sense and in a responsible sense. And there's a lot of M&A deals we've also seen in the nickel space just in the last year with Noront and Western Areas. Do you think that that's a trend we're going to continue to see, where the good projects are going to get scooped up either by other mining companies and or lock in supply agreements and have strategic stakeholders with those car companies and battery companies directly?
Yes and yes. I think you'll continue to see M&A interest from the traditional larger mining companies, all of whom are pretty uniformly bullish and constructive on nickel now. And that's a 180 degree change from what their thoughts on nickel were even 2 or 3 or 4 years ago. So the miners, I think, see this, you know, strong, persistent demand for nickel going forward to support the economic case to develop new mines. And yeah, we've seen examples of even some of the Korean companies making upstream equity investments into nickel project explorers and developers in order to secure offtake. And that is a theme that we will absolutely continue to see. The automakers cannot just afford to sit back and rely on the nickel industry or the mining industry to magically rain down nickel units from the sky. The auto industry, I think, will be compelled to have to make upstream investments. And we will continue to see that theme emerge here, I think, quite strongly in the years to come. And that gives companies like FPX and other nickel explorers and developers another potential source of capital to move our projects along here in years to come.
Final comment then here, Martin. Wrap us up with just a quick summary in terms of what you see as the key catalyst for nickel and what investors need to be aware of in terms of any shocks to the system, anything that could pull back the general nickel price or distract people from further the nickel sector.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'd say key catalysts, I wouldn't point to any one thing. I think you just continue to see year over year that nickel demand is modeled by almost every analyst continue to be higher than nickel supply. That will continue to pull down nickel stocks, and you will continue to see, I think, a fairly consistent grind higher in the nickel price. In terms of shocks, you know, the one thing it doesn't quite get to, I think, your question here, but one of the really important things about nickel is that it has high geopolitical concentration in countries that are subject to having sanctions or to making decisions that restrict nickel exports. So places like Indonesia and the Philippines have had huge geopolitical risk associated with them for their nickel supply in years gone by that has led to price spikes when they've pulled back on exports. And then, you know, the other kind of elephant in the room for nickel supply currently certainly is Russia, which represents, you know, circa 10 to 11% of global nickel supply if there are any sanctions arising on from any kind of military action that Russia may take here that are well publicized, that could really constrain the amount of nickel that's available for export from Russia to other countries. So again, be watchful of the very high sort of geopolitical risk of supply in nickel. In terms of downside risk in nickel, I would say, you know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, the rise of LFP batteries. These are batteries that do not use any nickel in them. And some people kind of read through that to kind of question the role of nickel in batteries going forward. I think that's, you know, much ado about nothing. LFP is well known. It will continue to play a strong role as a part of the EV battery market, but it has fundamentally much, much lesser performance in terms of range and charging time than high nickel containing battery technologies. Beyond just kind of global sort of, you know, diminishing GDP growth, et cetera, I don't see a lot that's specific to nickel that could, you know, upend, you know, the bull case here in the medium to longer term.
All right, Martin, really appreciate you fielding some of those questions that we have been sent and trying to provide a little bit more clarity broadly on the nickel market. If anybody has any follow-up questions regarding the nickel market, investments in the nickel sector, feel free to email us either fleck@kereport.com or shad@kereport.com. And we will follow up with Martin, as he is our go-to when it comes to the nickel market, as well as updates from FPX. So, hey, Martin, we really appreciate your time today and sharing some of your insights on the nickel market. Thanks again for your time.
Thanks, guys.